coming to you live from high atop some greasy dude's head. I'm Tom Rich, and with me as always is sentient dandruff. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode Dope, The Hobo Pope's Oboe Rope.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Burt Bacharach.
And I'm Clint...
Cosby?
No, Clintson.
Clint Clintson.
Clint Clintson, yeah.
You got to be careful saying that.
You really want to take it easy and enunciate.
Because otherwise people might think that you are actually the son of a person named Clint.
But
you know,
not.
Clint. Clint's son?
Yeah. And that's not right.
That would be misleading.
It would be weird and awkward, but especially since they might think you were implying that you were your own child. Clint. Clint's son.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that implies some high concept time travel shenanigans, which is not what we want to talk about here.
No shenanigans allowed.
I forget what you were. Who are you?
Oh, I just said Burt Bacharach.
Oh, Burt Bacharach. I'm Clint Clintson. But for tonight, in tonight's episode, we'll be taking on the roles of Tom Rich and...
Johannes Stauffer.
So that's going to be the sketch we're doing tonight. Tom and Johannes are board game designers from Michigan, and they have a podcast that they talk about board games on.
So they sound like huge losers.
Oh, they are. But we're going to be pretending to be them.
I don't know if I can do it. Can you give me, like, lead me in a little bit here? Give me, you know, what's my character's motivation for this?
Rage and fury and also anger.
Those seem like really weird reasons to, you know, like, talk about board games on the internet.
Well, you see... he's just very upset about things.
Okay.
And so he has to express that by doing the most pointless thing he can imagine. To harm those around him.
And how does that help?
It doesn't. It makes things actually worse.
I think I get it.
It's deeply self-sabotaging.
Yeah. All right.
Meanwhile, his partner is a man-child. Are you ready? Are we doing this?
I think so.
Okay. Getting into character. Okay, yeah.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Tom Rich.
We have a podcast about board games.
Those are different from beard games. So for tonight's podcast about board games, we're each going to take on the role of a player of a board game. I'm going to be Clint Clintson.
Oh my God. No, we're not doing that.
Can we add the Inception sound there? The blah thing? We need to go deeper.
We don't need to.
We could.
No.
We could go deeper if we wanted to. Cupola. Little ways.
It's pronounced cupola.
Oh. I thought it was pronounced sepulcher. Right? It's very disappointing that we went there.
We didn't. You did.
You set it up.
No.
If you lob a big, fat... ball into my half of the arena, I'm gonna knock it back, and I'm gonna say the word sepulcher while I do it. Like,
yeah,
that's,
but like
that's partly on you.
No, it's not, because you say words wrong and I correct you. That's on you. And then sometimes it's funny to make I believe it's pronounced this joke all of its own that we didn't steal from Penny Arcade without you then going to the Penny Arcade joke. Funnier, I believe, the first way.
I don't think I follow.
I can tell.
Right. So, the internet, podcasting, board games, that's what we're doing. That's what's going on tonight. We're going to talk about the stuff, have a few drinks. We're going to have a great time. It's going to be fun.
Have you ever noticed that you make the assumption with every recording that our listeners listen at night?
They don't?
I don't know. Some of them might.
When else would they listen? Where it's live and we're talking about it now and it's nighttime.
So. Yeah, but you even do it when we're not recording at night.
When have we ever not recorded at night?
We've recorded on some Saturdays and stuff.
It doesn't sound right.
It's not even night right now. It's like evening. It's different.
Isn't it more prevening?
Yeah, it kind of is. Well, it's pretty close to evening.
So it was like uneven, but now it's evening.
Is there a time? I see the joke you made there. Very good. When it officially ceases to be afternoon and becomes evening.
I think it's whenever you stop for the day.
So there is no evening.
It never stops. Yeah, no, there isn't. It's a fiction. It's a myth propagated by the bourgeois elite to keep the proletariat down.
They're always trying to do that.
I know, right?
Just plotting, twirling their mustaches.
Rubbing their hands together.
Yeah.
Making their butlers bring them stuff.
Making their butlers buttle in general.
Just buttling all over the place. Buttling sounds a lot like the sound like a beetle would make as it moves across the floor, like it's just buttling.
Yeah.
Like, look at it go.
Buttle, 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 buttle.
So I was sitting at home the other day and a beetle just buttled right across my coffee table.
Would it be buttled or did it just buttle?
Well, past tense.
Right. Yeah. But like it already sounds like the past tense of perhaps of beetle. Buttle. A beetle beetles or in the past it buttle.
It buttle. It buttle across the floor. It doesn't sound right, but it does now a little bit. Does it have a unique future tense or is it just will buttle?
Yeah, probably just will have been buttling.
Was having will buttle d.
That one doesn't work.
No, you don't work. I called your bosses and got you fired
from
all of your jobs. So now you are destitute.
Poverty stricken.
Yep. Gonna have to live under an overpass.
Better than having to live over an underpass.
Drinking your gin through a milk bag.
This isn't Canada. We don't have milk in bags.
Yeah, but you're so poor you have to go to Canada and get bags to drink your gin through.
That makes so little sense. We should talk to the...
District attorney?
Yes.
About the case? That we're investigating?
The case of what are we actually talking about in this segment.
Dun dun.
Was that supposed to be the Law and Order music?
Yeah, like, I can't really make that noise with my mouth.
Right. What are we talking about in this segment?
So tonight's segment, the first segment we're talking about is going to be called Hot Swappin'.
Oh, actually, just a real quick shout out to my brother Rick, who was irate that we spent nearly 10 minutes. On whatever bullcrap we talked about before getting to the topic in the first segment of last week's podcast.
He wasn't a fan of that, was he?
He didn't care for it.
Oh, well. Has he listened to any of the other episodes? They're not
that
better.
That may be, the problem.
Has he met either of us in his 30-plus years of life on this planet?
Yeah, I think so.
I assume he's pretty sure. 30. I wouldn't know, though, for sure.
He turned 35.
Did he really?
2 days ago.
It's good work. It's a hard age to reach.
He made it. Now he has arrived. He no longer has to do anything else. 35 is it.
Like a lot of people get to 34 and then they think they're going to get to 35, but they muff the landing and wind up 36.
Or they really they're like, I can't do it. 35 is too hard. And they spend at least another year, 34.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So good on you, Rick, for making it.
You did it.
For hitting
you
that
finally
target.
Did it.
It's tricky. You know, I know it was a dream of yours for a very long time.
We were all pulling for you.
You did the work. You really practiced at being 35 when you were 34. And it shows, really. Really quite an accomplishment. Quite, really very spectacular. I'm proud. It's what makes this country great, really, right there. That's the example we all should be following.
So we're going to put his email address and cell phone number in the show notes if any of you want to contact him with birthday wishes or
congratulations.
Requests, you know, as one of the few successful 35-year-olds.
Right, right.
For things that he might, pointers he could give you.
Facts about marsupials.
Or if you just want to kiss the ring that he received for turning 45. He's 45 now.
Right.
He skipped a decade.
Yeah, he was just like, if 35 was good, 45's got to be better. I'm just going to plow right on ahead.
Yeah.
I'm just going to. Gonna just knock down those pins between me and the next one and call it good.
And
scene.
10 minutes.
So today's topic is hot swapping.
The hottest.
Just warm, moist, but not like drippy swaps that you might take.
God, that's so disgusting.
I do try. So hot swapping is not to be confused with wife swapping. Those are very different things.
Right.
We're talking about trading in games. Games where you and other players have a variety of resources that you can swap amongst one another. Where games that have some kind of internal economy to them.
Hot swapping is when you can remove a piece of hardware from a machine that's still running. Mm-hmm. USB devices are hot swappable. Firewire is supposed to be, but isn't always. Where with wife swapping, you actually have to shut the device down first and then swap and then boot it up again. If you try to, you can't see because...
Right. They'll probably object, so...
Yeah.
You got to just bop them on the head and then trade. And then when they wake up, you're just like, now it's we've done that.
How does this apply to board games?
It doesn't, really. Just doesn't at all.
Why did you bring it up, then?
I don't know. Make Ricky really, really mad?
So swapping, trading.
Swapping and trading. So kind of what considerations go into designing that kind of game? What kind of games do we have where it seems to work well, if we've really played a lot of them, even? And how does one design an internal economy for a game that is going to be engaging and interesting as opposed to dumb and also stupid?
And also dumb.
And bad. And dumb.
I got nothing. Want to move on to the next segment?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that kind of jumps out with these things is that there's usually some kind of cap on the total amount of resources available to all of the players.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you look back to a game that you hate, The Settlers of Catan,
mm-hmm.
the amount of resources you can trade among each other is sort of, if I remember it right, it's been a while since I played it, is capped by the amount that have been produced into the game at that point.
Right.
Like, there's no bank to swap with. That kind of sets it apart from Monopoly, where the bank never runs out of money. You can always trade with it.
Well, the bank does run out of money, though.
No, but the official rules of Monopoly, I just saw an Imgur post about it. You're supposed to just keep going with slips of
paper.
Just
pretend as though...
Yeah. The bank has money.
That's dumb.
Well, it's in the post-FDIC world, so it's fine.
Okay.
Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Yep.
Franklin Roosevelt, Great Depression.
Right.
History. But, so...
He called it that, actually. The original meaning of that initialism was Franklin Delano is cool. And then he backronymed it to FDIC. Federal,
that,
whatever.
That correction. Sounds like an FDR move right there. So you've got a limited amount of resources that players... If you want your players to have to trade with each other, you got to give them a reason to, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to somehow artificially restrain what each individual player is going to have. And if there's only so much for all the players and it's not enough for each player to do everything they want to, that's going to force some swaps to occur.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's kind of neat.
It's different in... I'm just thinking, as a kid, there were games with trading. And just like The very term trading card,
right,
is, you know, there were games like Pogs where supposedly you were supposed to keep the Pogs that you won.
Sure.
But then, like, that caused so many fights and then banning of various toys and games from elementary school when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly in Marbles, you're supposed to do the same thing. I believe Jax? Is Jax the thing you just play by yourself? I don't even know.
I don't know.
But then, Jax. Like, Pokemon cards... I don't know that there are express written rules with, like, Magic cards. But when those came about, those collectible card games, they were still calling them trading card games.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that, like, you would have to trade something you bought to another person and potentially not have it anymore was a very kind of, like, gambly aspect. And sure. it sort of disappeared, I think, from that.
Yeah, definitely. Magic was actually kind of funny in its very, very early days, like in the very deepest, earliest 90s. Because an ante was an official part of the rules.
Really?
Like, written into the rule book. You were supposed to flip the top card of your deck and set it aside, and you couldn't play it at all in that game. And it was your ante, and the winner got to keep all the anteed cards.
Wow.
And there were actual cards in the game that interacted with the ante. Like, you could swap them out for it, and then you would be able to use it. Or you could ante an extra card to do extra effects and stuff. But
wow.
It's all been, that's all been removed over time. It's just completely gone.
I would never play that game because Magic cards are so expensive. I mean, I guess I didn't really play Magic either, but
they would be
an instant, like, nope, not doing that.
Yeah, they weren't as bad when they first came out like that, but that part very, very quickly left the game.
Yeah. But trading in a contained game like a board game, what we call a board game, mm-hmm. A tabletop game generally that comes in a box. It might have expansions. It might have more stuff you can add on to it. But it you know, if you're trading, you're trading among players. It all goes back in the box at the end of the day, at the end of the game. Tom came up with this topic, so I blame mm-hmm. him. But I don't even know where to begin. Yeah, and you were leading us somewhere, and I sidetracked you a bit. But like, there's so many different reasons you can trade. So you were saying you have to force sort of a limited resource pool so that trading is necessary. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, sometimes it's, you know, you have to trade. That's a driving mechanic. Sometimes it's just like you can trade. You know, you can trade mm-hmm. cards in your hand as long as they have the same or lesser value or whatever, like that kind of thing. It can be cooperative. It can be competitive. It can be neutral. Mm-hmm. It's all over the place.
Yeah, definitely.
So we kind of need to pick which one or a couple we're going to talk about, or we'll be here forever and then we'll die because we don't live forever.
So for me, it's most interesting as an idea for a mechanic when there's something that pushes the players in that direction is to make deals with one another. Like, if it's just sort of tacked on, like, oh, if you want to, you can swap cards.
Okay.
That doesn't feel like it's part of the game.
All right, so we're going to call trading... Let's define it. Trading is intentional, probably bartered.
Intentional, bartered. Yeah, I think if it's built into... There's a specific route by which it's always 1-2 or 3-1 or whatever.
Uh-huh.
That's not as interesting. But if you can say, I've got, you know, I have 12 matchstick and I want to give you 4 of them for 3 of your dogs.
But okay.
You can barter a little bit.
All right. So we're going to say that express monetary transactions are out. We're not going to talk about monopoly money.
I mean, if money is a resource in the game, that's fine. I don't think you want to limit it to particular types of resources.
Sure. But if, this, you know, this card has a price, you can buy it off me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's not... Now, if there is money and I have a card, I'm like, I'll take 15 for it, even though I bought it for 20 or whatever.
Sure.
That's... Now we're talking trade a little more.
Yeah, that kind of exchange among players.
We're not... Among players, too, yeah. We're not going to talk just money changes hands kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I had one other point to make, but I've forgotten what it is. Maybe I'll think of it again later.
Hopefully.
Cool. So I feel like I have a better handle on it. Does that still... I've not played much Catan because I don't care for it. Mm-hmm. Does that still... Like, are there virtually outside the rules, like, barter however you want?
Yeah, you can trade as many bricks for sheep as you want.
Okay. We don't play a lot of games like this, generally because they tend to be economic engine, Euro-y, mm-hmm. you know, high in calculation, low in anything ever happening that's interesting, competitive games that I don't enjoy.
True.
There is definitely a bartery trade aspect in Cosmic Encounter. If you choose, I mean, you have to get there, so it's pretty contained within the negotiate cards, right? Mm-hmm. But once two players play a negotiate card, now you're in pretty raw trade territory. You can offer anything in game for anything in game in return,
mm-hmm.
at all. I don't think it's even limited in the rules. You might even be able to offer your turn. I've never seen it done, but I don't see why it wouldn't be possible.
That would be goofy.
Like, you can have my next turn if you give me your hand, you know, or well, yeah, like I don't see in marriage. It's kind of interesting because that one is on a time limit, and mm-hmm. so that sort of like way outside the box.
Yeah, and that points towards an easy problem with trading games is that, like any kind of negotiating game where you or voting or any kind of mechanic where the players have to talk to one another and there's no concrete thing forcing a resolution
uh-huh.
within the mechanics, it can drag.
Yeah,
especially if you've got somebody who thinks they're like, you know, the great diplomat who can forge the best deals. They think they're Donald Trump. You know, the best deals. Huge. No. You gotta give me the wall. You gotta give me the wall. Look, I'll give you the bricks. You'll give me the wall.
I believe you mean they think they are who Donald Trump thinks
No. You're not listening. You're not fair. You're being very unfair to Trump. Very unfair to Trump. And it's gonna be great. It's gonna be huge. And great people, wonderful people play these games. Amazing people. Terrific. Anyway, I think my Donald Trump needs some work.
Yeah.
It's not a great impression.
I wouldn't work too much on it.
No, it's...
Don't waste your time.
That's fair.
Maybe work on your Hillary. You just have to eat a handful of steel wool every day. And eventually, you'll be as grating and awful.
Mm-hmm.
But you won't have to affect an accent of any kind, I don't think.
Nah, not really. She's pretty bland that way.
Yeah.
In accent-wise.
So, trading games, you were saying something about... Oh, people who think they're the great diplomat, yeah. And it drags on.
Yeah, it takes forever and a day. So you got to have some mechanic that will force a resolution. I like myself for that. I think that the mechanic from Codenames, where you just have a timer that anybody can flip when things are dragging and just be like, now you're on a timer.
I adore that mechanic.
I want that mechanic to be in...
every single game.
Not only to be in all of my games, all of our games, but also to be my firstborn child.
That's weird.
Yeah, I'm a weird guy like that.
So I really like the openness of that. Trade whatever outside the game rules mechanic. It works well in Cosmic because of the timer.
Mm-hmm.
And it could get awful if it drags on for too long. And so the mechanic with the timer that you're talking about could be helpful in other situations.
Mm-hmm.
But it's potentially game-breaking.
How so?
Because it goes outside the rules. If you can trade anything... So say you go to trade a turn,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing to say that's not allowed. First of all, so you've got the time sink of other people being like, no, you can't do that, and having to explain... There are no rules for this. I can do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
And then now having a second turn is giving the player who gets that such a leg up on all of the players.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like it unbalances things. And there's just so many places with no rules, with all rules out the window, you can really break the game. And then there's also weird things you could bring in. And I feel like most games with that sort of open trading mechanic still say any game resource, but you could straight up, if it was totally open, you could say, give me $15 in real life. Like, you know, what's your price? I'll let you win. You can have everything that I have for $100 cash. How much does this game really mean to you? Entertaining,
yeah.
But not entertaining for everyone
not
playing.
No, so you certainly want to put some limits on it, yeah. to keep it within the bounds of an interesting game. Yeah, so we like you certainly need to limit negotiations to some degree, and you need to limit what can be swapped. Maybe you keep it pretty open, but at least limit it to in-game items.
Yeah.
Don't let somebody give you, you know, their cat. Or maybe do, if you want that. The cat, I don't know.
So
it's not my life.
I like those, I think we've established that I like those more open trade mechanics. The more you lock them down, to me anyway, the less interesting they become. So you can trade items
mm-hmm.
in Arkham Horror, and it's a matter of function. You know, you just have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you have the holy water that I need, and I have whatever that you need. That's trading in that items are changing hands, but you don't have to give me anything. You can give me the holy water and right. I don't give you anything because we're allies. So that's already a difference. If you see it in a context that's cooperative, it's still called trading, but it's not barter trading, right?
Right. It's a slightly different animal.
But also, it's not really interesting. It's a mechanic that's useful. You need to be able to do that, but it doesn't really add anything to the game.
True. True. Yeah, yeah. So there needs to be an element of competition to it, I think, to make it an interesting
Yeah, yeah, especially to be a game-driving mechanic.
Right. Right, right.
I don't know that I've played much that does it.
No, not really. Now that we've established all of these parameters.
All of the rules that we have established.
It doesn't seem like we've really played many of those.
Are there all that many of those? I mean, Catan does it.
I think the game Archipelago does it, which we haven't played because it's expensive and I think out of print. A lot of Euros.
Okay, so there's trading in Bonanza.
Oh, that's true.
Much more limited trading, I think. But I think you can... I don't know how limited it is, right? Because you can just say, I have... You know, you have a bean I want and I have all of these anyone want.
For those not in the know, Bonanza is the finest bean farming game you're ever likely to play.
Yeah, that's an apt description. It's about bean farming.
You farm beans.
And then the beans have been farmed.
And you have them and they're farmed.
On a bean farm.
On a bean farm.
It's called Bonanza. Different Bonanza.
Because B-O-H-N is the German word for bean. I think.
Sure.
I don't know what I expected when I Googled that, but...
Bone? So I think that's actually probably the best example of this. Because that's really the driving mechanic, and it is the least limited, but it, like, it's still, you know, within the game. You can't trade cold, hard cash. You can't trade a fistful of nickels for someone's red beans or whatever they are. And it's kind of interesting. That game somewhat fairly models an economy in some way. And, like, there's a sort of supply and demand. You have to make a judgment on what cards you think are coming, right, through the deck.
Yeah.
Before you decide to trade away all of your blue... And you have to make the judgment, like, is what I'm getting from this guy who's willing to trade with me worth giving him... Because he clearly wants what, to me, are useless. Am I actually helping him too much just to get something that I kind of need? And that's where it becomes interesting. There's a little bit of, like, it's not even really hidden information, right? Because your hand is open. But no one knows what you're going to do with it. And so if someone's willing to trade with you, in my experience of that game, it immediately makes you question their motives for being willing to trade. Like, you start off, you're like, I really need to get rid of these and I really need something else. Someone please take them. And if someone's like, yeah, I'll trade you that, you're like, why?
What do you know that I don't? And who sent you?
It brings in a really social aspect to the game where now you're trying to read, like, you're like, wait, is this worth it? Am I going to help him? Is he going to, like, make a ton of money off of this bean trade? Where we trade beans that we have farmed on our bean farms.
I adore
that game. This game is amazing.
It's so good. It's actually got a lot of really cool design features to it.
Yeah.
Highly recommend if you can get a chance to play it. Yeah, you're right, though, that to make the trades interesting, you need that element of supply and demand that ebb and flow for different things to put some pressure on you to want certain items at certain times versus others.
Yeah. I feel like there must be, we don't have all the expansions, but there must be a card in
Dominion?
Yep, that allows trading of cards in your hand, whether they're victory cards or action cards.
I would certainly think so.
And I feel like that is a great environment for that sort of thing to happen, because in Dominion, so much of the rules are set by the card in your hand as you're playing it, that you could do some really interesting things with it. On the other hand, it could also just be really boring. Now, they do a really good job of it, generally, when they add cards with new mechanics. You're like, oh, that's cool, that works. So, not a judgment on the designers of Dominion, but it could be done really poorly or it could be done really well. And I imagine it must have been done. I haven't seen it yet.
I would think so, but I don't know.
But it seems like what we're coming down to here is that a trading mechanic, in order for it to be more than just... like a necessary feature, like the trading mechanic in Arkham, in order for it to be interesting and engaging, it needs to be limited, but not too limited.
Right.
It needs to allow a lot of the social aspect of, you know, maybe I'm going to put way too much out there offering all these cards for your card, all these beans for your bean, whatever it is, and risk it. Or I feel like I'm making a trade that it's really safe, but you're so gung-ho to do it that now I'm questioning whether I'm gonna screw everyone over by giving you something you need, even though I can't imagine why you need it. There needs to be more than just cards or tokens changing hands for it to really be engaging.
Yeah, and it needs to be driving other parts of the game and putting pressure on you to do certain things. Like in a Dominion situation, you don't want to just be swapping cards. You also want to be pushing yourself to get different cards as a result of the trade you made. Yeah, it's cool. It's neat.
Well, if you have suggestions for games that use a trading mechanic and do so well, I'm discovering just through this conversation here that I actually like it a lot. I just don't tend to like some of the games that use it.
Sure.
So if you have suggestions for trading games, I would love to hear them. You could tell us on Twitter at @mildlyalarming.
You could email us on email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You could post a comment in the comment section on the website. And join the ranks of such other website commenters as Gary Smoulihan, and I think my wife one time, and probably no one else ever, at www.mildlyalarming.com or on facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow.
Or you could develop a raging case of dermatographia, which is where you can just sort of rub your fingernail on your arm and like it swells up a little bit and you can draw pictures and stuff. Use that to write your message on your torso. Find us, lift up your shirt, and then we'll see your message.
My wife has that, but if she were to like write a message on her torso and lift up her shirt for you, I might, you know, have questions.
That would be weird. My coworker has it as well.
Good for him and or her.
Him.
We'll be right back after this word from our I Don't Care sponsors. Bye.
The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by the Women's Modified Hurl Boating Championships, ongoing in West Saskatuck, Connecticut. Let's go to the announcers for an update.
Welcome back to the Women's Modified Hurl Boating Championships. I'm Cluxman Bovian, and with me is Harold Yarg, filling in for Simon Pyman, who was away this week at the Skeet Shooting Championships. Hope he brought a poncho, Harold.
It is supposed to rain in Detroit this weekend, Clux. There's been some great hurl boating action this morning, and I've understood none of it. Some meaty-calfed dame hucked a canoe at a lady with a frankly terrifying neck, the second woman broke the canoe with her face, and the judges split the points 8-4. Why? I have no idea.
Oh, hang on, Harold. Gwynnifred Muldoon is stepping up to the hurl boating stake. She's been on a real rise this season, really coming on strong with the kayak and catamaran classes.
That sounds impressive, but she's just picked up a rowboat, which isn't one of the things you mentioned, so...
Well, no, Harry, she wouldn't dare try for a kayak in these winds. That's what I'm saying about the season Gwynnifred's having, just really showing some discernment, which is the hallmark of a good hurlboater. See, she's thinking, her opponent, Julie the Bermuda Triangle Candle Froth, has tried to steal the match with a paddleboard.
Is that what that was? It looked like she just ran up to Gwynnifred and tried to smack her upside the head with it.
To a layman it would, Harry, but to the practiced eye it's clear that she was doing exactly that. But Gwynnifred's dodged it. She has. Oh, that'll put Julie in a bad spot. I wouldn't want to be her when that rowboat comes sailing down pitch. There's the windup. The throw. Oh, what a hit! What a hit!
That is really quite gruesome.
What a throw that was, Harry. A textbook rowboat, straight to the teeth.
I think a severed lip flew up and got stuck to the announcer's booth window.
Wouldn't be the first time, Harry. Looks like they'll be a bit picking teeth up out of the pitch. Good time for a message from one of our fine sponsors. This year's Women's Modified Hurl Boating Championship is brought to you by the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Let's listen in for an update on that. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast, everybody. I'm Tom Rich.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And wasn't that some really remarkable hurl boating coverage just now? I'm a big fan myself, and just great stuff going on at the championships this year.
I've never really gotten all that into it, but I have to admit that it is impressive to see a woman throw an entire rowboat or canoe one-handed off and that length. And with that accuracy.
You know, the distance is really the thing that gets me.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like if you were, like, just right across the room from me, I could hit you in the face with a rowboat. But to get it down the pitch far with that kind of arc and connect just with, like, the prow and not have it tumble end over end, that is some athletic skill right there. Truly remarkable stuff.
Seems messy, though. I want to know what their, you know, the guys who do the cleanup managers or whatever they're called.
Sure.
What do they get paid?
It's got to be good because they're scraping all kinds of parts out of the grass after somebody takes a kayak to the chin.
Probably off the boats. I don't imagine the athletes have to clean their own equipment.
I wouldn't think so.
At a pro level, anyway.
No, certainly not at a pro level. Well, I mean, at a pro level, that's all got to be provided just to make sure there's no funny business.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know, baseball players are bringing their own bats. Hurl boaters aren't bringing their own boats.
Yeah.
It's probably made to some specification by a custom company and all that.
I wonder, too, though, are they even, you know, do they even work as boats anymore?
Oh, that's a
good
point.
Or is it one of those things where, you know, traditionally it began with boats, but now they still physically resemble the boats of yore, but really they're all fiberglass or you know, graphite or something.
Well, you can make a boat out of fiberglass.
You can, but if it doesn't need to hold water, does it?
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying, yeah.
And is it lighter? Is it more aerodynamic? You know,
sure, I don't know.
Like, even in stock car racing, you know, those are just Lexan, you know, heavy-duty, like, plastic bodies that don't weigh what a car actually weighs. Mm-hmm. It looks like one, but there's no headlights. Those are decals. You know, there's so much stuff missing because it's got to keep the weight down.
Huh. I don't know.
Are the gunnels on that rowboat really the same gunnels on my rowboat? I tend to doubt it.
You're probably not. I mean, at that level of competition, you want to have more quality control over your utensils then.
Yeah.
Otherwise, but man, did you see that one gal take that kayak just right to the ribs?
Yeah, that was rough.
That had to hurt bad. I mean, like, she got up, but not well. That's one of the things with hurlboating that throws me off, though. Because it's like, yeah, it's some great athleticism, a long tradition, too.
Yeah.
A lot of tradition there. But still, I don't think we'll be seeing it in 20 years. I think it's going to get shut down, honestly. I mean, it's just too violent.
I don't
for
know.
Modern times.
I mean, UFC's going strong.
Yeah, but UFC doesn't involve, you know, catamarans sailing into people's throat parts.
Not often, anyway.
Nobody's taken a paddleboard to the clavicle in UFC. It's just not happening.
I don't know. I get the feeling it's one of those sports where if you think you can't take a paddleboard to the clavicle, just you're not going to make it to the pros in the first place.
That's a fair point. But I worry about the kids, though, that get into, like, junior hurlboating.
Oh, yeah, that's
you know,
true.
That's...
The Rec and Ed weekend hurlboating.
Yeah, that's... I mean, like, it's a good way to build...
Those definitely aren't real boats.
No, certainly. They're much too small. Like, a toddler cannot lift a rowboat. That's just not going to happen, let alone throw it at another toddler.
Right.
I'd pay a little money to see that.
I would, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I worry that they're going to grow up stupid after taking that many kayaks to the head.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a lot of opposition to, you know, pads and helmets.
Well, I mean, for me, if you're going to add pads and helmets to hurlboating, just shut it all down. Because
you're a purist.
That's taking too much. It's not hurlboating anymore, then. You might as well end the sport. And that's fine. Like, it might be that we as a civilization can no longer hurlboat. We've gotten to a point where that's just not...
It's had its run.
Yeah, like how people used to bear bait. Like, you would have a bear chained up and have dogs kill it, and people would watch, and that was a great entertainment, and now we don't do that anymore?
I am 115% certain that still happens in Russia.
Well, yeah, but we're talking about here.
Okay.
Yeah, but no, we don't do that, and it wasn't like we were like, oh, but maybe the dogs could just lick the bear. No, we were just like, no, we're just done. Just
yeah,
because
the
good.
Dogs were down. They were like, we'll lick the bear. And the bear was like, I'm going to eat that dog.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, there are just some games and sports entertainments that just don't go on. You can't civilize them.
Right. Football.
Right.
There was a lot of outcry when football was first shut down, but now everyone agrees, as we said before, mm-hmm. not, you know, to put ourselves in the good guy camp, but...
Yeah.
We're on record as having said that football needed to go.
It had to,
and
it
finally
stop.
Did. And I think we've come to a point where, you know, the world understands that football was just not meant to be.
Well, but the thing with football that's interesting though is that it didn't go because it was dangerous or because it was causing traumatic brain injury. It went because it was stupid.
Uh-huh.
Like we collectively realized this is just
asinine.
It's just a dumb nonsense game for babies. And we're just not going to do it anymore. And then it shut down. And, you know, some people whined, but it was better that way. And I think we've all agreed now that it is better, that we don't have that anymore. Right. So, yeah. Football's done. Hurlboating probably going that way, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it boils down to. We're just not going to have hurlboating in 20 years. My kids certainly won't hurlboat. I wouldn't let them.
You wouldn't let them.
It's a little too dangerous.
Okay.
Honestly. Like, you know, if that's your passion, if you really want to be... I guess maybe if one was like, Dad, I just really want to hurlboat. That's what I want to do with my time. I guess, you know, they might talk me into it, but I'd be hesitant. And it would be hard to, you know, to watch them take a canoe to the face, really. But at the same time, it's like you can't protect them from anything. They're going to go out and they're going to do their thing and they're going to... adventure in the world, and it's going to happen, and you know, bad stuff will happen. They're going to get in car crashes and all kinds of things, and you know, maybe just a kayak upside the head isn't the worst thing that could happen to them in the world. Like they could vote for Donald Trump, for example. That could be a thing that happened. That's not as bad as taking a kayak to the chin. Just really, it's a different sort of thing, really. So I might be talked into letting them hurlboat. I guess there are definitely worse things than hurlboating. that they could do. Definitely a lot worse things. The Trump voting. They could be investment bankers. They could be people who open a bakery that advertises itself as a Jewish bakery but sneaks bacon into every loaf of bread. Just dribbles a little bit of bacon grease in there so that it's not really kosher, but they pretend it is. And that would be bad. Like, that's a bad thing to do. They could be that. And I would rather they were professional hurl boaters than that, certainly. They could throw bricks off of freeway overpasses at passing cars. That's not okay. Hurl boating is better than that. They might draw pictures of Mario with Luigi's head. That's not right. That's bad. They might hang out in front of churches during services and wait for people to come out and trip them and just stick their leg out as people are coming out the door and they trip and they fall. And then that's what they do with their time. That's not okay. That's a bad thing to do. I'd rather they hurl boat this. So there's, well, I guess what I'm saying is that hurl boating is not the worst thing in the world for people to do. So if they want to hurl boat, I'll let them hurl boat. I'll let my kids hurl boat. That's what I'm saying.
Glad we came to this decision.
It's a good decision to come to. So for our second segment for tonight, we're going to be just as a rowboat smashes into a hurlboater's jaw and scatters their teeth all over the pitch, so too in board game Smash-O-Rama do two board games come smashing together to make a new board game. I guess that analogy doesn't really work.
It's not a great analogy.
It's not the best one, really, but it's one we might use. So board game Smash-O-Rama, we pick two board games, we crash them together, and we see what comes out at the end of it. So in previous editions, I think we did Risk plus Monopoly, maybe? Something like that? I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Okay, we'll go with it. But for tonight, we're going to do The Resistance meets Risk.
So we're just doing Risk again?
Yeah, but with...
Provided that's what we did before.
Right.
Which doesn't sound right. It was Arkham meets...
Arkham meets Eclipse.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's different.
Arclipse.
Eclaham?
Eclaham Horror.
Yeah, I'd play that.
Yeah.
So The Resistance meets Risk. So for those not in the know, Risk is the game of global domination where you conquer the world with your armies, and 11 hours into it, you are disowned by your family.
Yeah.
Because that's how that works. And The Resistance is the game where you are resisting a evil empire, but two people in your group are spies of the empire. And you've got to try to figure out who they are before they sabotage all your missions and cause you to be caught and probably gulagged, I guess, is how that would happen.
Yep. So the problem with this smash up already, Smash-O-Rama, is that Risk is already incredibly long. And anything we could add to it is only going to add length to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Resistance is just great. Like, that's fine. That's
like
not a problem.
Yeah. So there's kind of two schools of thought we could go with to make Risk work better and keep its length from going too long. We could just eliminate the parts of it that go long and just put an arbitrary term limit on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could do what some of the other variants of Risk do, like Middle Earth Risk or Risk Legacy, where there's a sub victory condition underneath Conquer the World.
Uh-huh.
So like in Risk Legacy, for example, each faction has a little HQ model that they put somewhere on the board.
Uh-huh.
And if you control four of those, you win. So
okay.
You could put a sub thing under it to make it to give you an early victory condition to cause it to not drag on quite so bad. Now, no matter what you do, if you keep Risk's die mechanic, it drags on.
Yeah.
For the same reason that the First World War dragged on in the real world, which is that it gives a significant advantage to the defense, to static defense.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, battles take longer.
Right.
Because you're giving a significant advantage to static defense. And in the First World War, is because, you know, they'd invented machine guns and rockets and artillery and whatnot, and they dug trenches, and that's how that happened. But in Risk, it's because defender wins ties.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of ways we could go about it. But so what do you have any immediate thoughts on what might smash these two together?
Well, the one that leaps to mind anyway is just adding a spy mechanic and basically shoehorning the entirety of the Resistance into into a game of Risk. But I think that goes too large scale. So it would basically take a Risk-style game of global domination and add, you know, sort of a commander role for each color, you know, for each team.
Sure.
But then actually have sub officers who do various things like spying, but I think that's way too big. I think that would go forever, yeah. Regardless of how much we try to mitigate the length of a game of Risk.
Yeah, that would be rough. It'd be cool.
Yeah.
But you're almost getting like mega game territory where you need to set aside a day and have games masters and, mm-hmm. you know, like rent out a gym to play it in.
Right.
Which I want to try one of those if one ever comes to Ann Arbor. Yeah. Those sound cool as hell.
Speaking of which, we need to get on trying to figure out if we're going to try to do our own, host our own, Gnomic game.
Oh, Gnomic. Yes. We do need to do that. My immediate thought was, what if you introduce a mechanic to automate, or like an AI mechanic to automate the Risk portion of the game?
Okay.
So some simple metrics to decide where armies attack and whatnot and how they do stuff. And then use the resistance mechanic to try to influence those, how that plays out.
Okay.
So like your mission. So like one of the things in the resistance is that the missions are very abstract. So they just succeed or fail, but you never really know what you're doing.
Right.
What if your mission was to assassinate a general?
Okay.
And if it succeeds, now you assassinate the Green Army's general. Now the Green Army reduces all their die rolls by one, so they're more likely to lose battles they're in that round.
Okay. If you automate that, regardless of how you do the rest of it, if you automate that, it does speed it up significantly, so long as you don't feel the need to watch every single thing unfold. Because if you do app integration or something, have an app running the Risk portion of the game for the most part and just asking for your gameplay input on various effect on battles and intelligence and stuff, then it could go pretty quickly. The problem there is you lose the competitive aspect of Risk, and you've basically just added an unnecessary layer on top of what is effectively just the resistance.
Yeah, I mean, you lose the competitive aspect of Risk, but what if you each, instead of each player being assigned, you know, spy, not spy, you're assigned loyalty to one faction or another.
Right.
So you might be, so in some cases you might be like, well, I'm loyal to the Green faction, but our mission this turn is just blue versus red. So what do I care? Or how you have different inputs on how you're going to vote.
And so now you're voting. If you're sort of neutral in that way, gives you the ability to kind of to see alliances play out, I guess. So the question becomes then, how do you make alliances that work with the automated portion, but don't immediately show your hand? So if the battle's red versus blue and you're green, and you're allied with blue, red should know that already. And if you are allied with green, it should have some effect on the simulated battles in the app. So you will also have had to tell the computer that. Otherwise, it will be total nonsense when you two are pitted against one another in a battle.
Yeah, that doesn't work. That's a tricky one. That's a tricky nut to crack.
You could go another way, and using some of the like voting and bluffing mechanics from Resistance, but having it modeling more of a like UN or world government convention kind of thing, where you're trying to, maybe every player has, you know, their country or their team or whatever that they're representing, but they might also have like a condition that's not necessarily just outright victory for their, you know, their axis or their or their country, but it might be like, you know, you can give away all the reparations you need to the other side to end the war, so long as you come out with Poland, or you come out with having gotten rid of.
Yeah, so you're like a representative of a faction on the Security Council.
Yeah,
we'll call it for the sake of argument. And you might you have like you're part of that faction. So if that faction loses, you lose.
Yeah,
but maybe not, because you have your own personal goal.
Right.
So your personal, like, suppose you were represented the North American faction, the faction that starts there.
Yeah.
What if your goal could be something like, have no battles actually be fought in North America? And beyond that, you don't really give a shit how the war develops.
Yeah.
As long as you can manipulate things so that battles are never fought on your home turf.
Sure.
Or, you know, your goal is to end the war at all costs. So whatever it takes to stop the fighting.
Yeah.
You'll do it. So you might find in some games, it's like, I just need to get five people to vote with me to end the war now.
Yeah.
And I win. Or in other games, you're like, well, it's very clear that black is winning this round, this game, so I'm just going to commit
just
my
back
forces.
Back them entirely, yeah.
And then I'll be able to win there. That's cool.
Yeah, it's interesting.
There's some interesting stuff going on.
I think
on
it needs
there.
Some more fleshing out before it becomes either just as bloated as the initial idea was,
mm-hmm.
and needs to be a rent out a gymnasium and spend a weekend game. Or it could go the other way. It could be too simplistic, and you're just like, I just need to do this thing and this social interaction to make sure that I end up, you know, not losing my country's, not shrinking my country's borders at all,
mm-hmm.
and otherwise I don't care the outcome. Like, that can become so rote that you're just like, you vote very transparently,
mm-hmm.
and it's not, there's no bluffing, there's no social interaction that really needs to happen.
Sure.
I don't know how much that bears discussing, because a lot of that probably comes down to just the balancing of the
design choices.
The design choices and yeah.
It's pretty neat, though.
I like the idea.
You would need something to because if you're going to be a representative of the Security Council, you're obviously not also the president of your country. Duh.
Right.
Of course. But so you need some way of having the country, like, you need some say on how your country operates, obviously,
right.
because otherwise it's not fun. But you also need some way where, like, your country's just going to do its thing.
Yeah.
And, like, I could see it being fun if you had, like, one player. This is too big. But one player who was the Security Council rep and one player who was the president of the countries.
Yeah.
And had to actually run the battles. And they had to kind of negotiate between each other. But they have differing objectives. And it's so much fun. But then you're getting up to, like, a 10-player game. That's not
going to
happen.
Yeah, that's pretty big. You could do it. Actually, I think where we're headed with this, you could almost get rid of the automation.
Mm-hmm.
Of the, so you lose most of what is a risk other than the map,
sure.
really. Now, I guess you'd still need some of it, but you could probably get it down to a point where you could do it with dice rolls. You could just say, you know, these are the, based on the voting, these are the forces that have committed troops to one side or the other of
mm-hmm.
this. And so we could conceivably get this to a point where it is just a board game that doesn't require, you know, that we could make, that doesn't
mm-hmm.
need the ability to write a rudimentary AI and design an app to run
sure.
it. I do like, though, with the, if you keep the AI, otherwise you're just rolling on a table. If you keep the AI, you could have a huge slew of choices for an automated, you know, prime minister or president or whatever that you have to report back to
mm-hmm.
who will approve or deny your, you know, whatever you present. So the end, every round could have the discussion and the voting portion, and then you may vote and come to a decision that you would like,
mm-hmm.
or even you may come to a decision that you would like, but then there's a phase where you have to go back to your country and check it with your superiors,
sure.
and then you come back and vote. And so it may have looked at the end of open table discussion like everyone was going to come down on the same page, or like at least it was clear that the North American, or, you know, the American continental powers were going to come to one decision and the European and Asian
mm-hmm.
and African powers were going to come to another, whatever it is. But then you come back and people vote differently, because even though things discussed between the delegates came out one way, quieter, secret, you know, through the app or through rolling on a table or whatever, forced your hand the other way. And so you come back and have to or choose to
mm-hmm.
vote differently.
Right.
And it kind of, it can throw things. But yeah, now we're back into app territory and,
yeah.
you know, many, many, many variables.
Yeah, but it's so cool.
I like the concept. I want to find a way to make it work without having to develop an app for
it. Yeah, I always want to make it work without developing an app for it.
Mostly because neither of us knows how to write an app.
I know how to write apps.
No, you don't.
Oh, okay. No, I don't.
App means application, not appetizer.
Oh, yeah, because I know how to spell appetizer.
Do you?
A-P-P-P-P-E-T... T-T-I-Z-Z-E-R-R-R-Tizer.
Tizer. I think that's the French spelling.
Oh, sorry.
Most of those letters are silent.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Especially the Tizer. That one is silent.
Tizer is a French letter introduced by Napoleon I that is pronounced... Ah, fantastic. Yeah, though, that would be really cool. Now, do you think it still needs, like, production and the building of troops and all of that stuff? Or
it could use that stuff, I guess. I don't know how necessary it is. And also, if you're putting the player in the position of being on the Security Council or whatever, the delegate,
mm-hmm.
they probably don't have the powers to make those decisions, right? Yeah. That's the sort, like, it could be there, but it would be abstracted through the automated president.
And I guess too, if you're having a Security Council, it's like a modern or near future type of scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not fighting a medieval or a Napoleonic type of war
right.
anymore. And so troops are so mobile at that point that you could probably just abstract it with an overall military strength of the country.
Uh-huh.
And it could commit its forces, you know, one way or another based on that, but
well, what could be interesting, or it could be impossible to model, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about this here, but is just take risk and make it risk, but base it on the technology of today rather mm-hmm. than like World War One, World War Two.
So
because already, like, if World War Two, if all of those powers were to come together in combat in the way that they did for World War II, it would be a completely different animal mm-hmm. because the level of technology is so different with mm-hmm. just, you know, satellites and cruise missiles alone change everything.
Yeah.
And yeah, cruise missiles, nuclear weapons, all that stuff.
I mean, you can almost make that shift just by switching it from ties go to the defender to ties go to the attacker.
Yeah.
Which is a crude way to simulate that, but
sure, but even beyond that, I mean, if you look at it before you're committing numbers of troops,
mm-hmm.
and if, you know, if you were going to model it even more granularly, there's time to get them across the ocean on boats. Now it's like, no, we fired the missile and it got there in a couple hours.
Yeah.
And that alone is already an interesting abstraction. So taking the risk approach of global war with a map, adding this Security Council idea with the resistance mechanic, but then also taking in consideration, like, you could do it Civ style, like the Civilization games, where this is getting really bloaty too, but
mm-hmm.
your given country could have a different level of, you know, part of your discussion and part of your gameplay could be trying to get your country to a higher technology level. So maybe
sure.
you start out at World War One or at you know, colonial or civil war or whatever era, but you could get better technology. That kind of stuff makes, I don't think
yeah.
we necessarily need that granular, but it makes the game so very, very different. It becomes mm-hmm. really hard to model, or at least interesting mm-hmm. to model.
So one of the things we haven't talked about much, and I like everything you're saying there. So, but one of the things we haven't mentioned much is that one of the resistances made the resistance
uh-huh.
by the fact that you have a couple of people who are voting against everybody's best interests.
Right.
And everybody else is voting more or less the same way.
Sure.
And we, right now we've modeled each person voting their own interest.
Uh-huh.
But we don't have that same sense of a couple of people are just out to screw with everybody else at the same time. Are you thinking like maybe like a terrorist nation on the Security Council?
Well, that's where I was going at the beginning there with the little sub victory conditions. They mm-hmm. may not even necessarily be like outright you win victory conditions. They're just like, this is your preference, or, you know, maybe they accrue points, you know, mm-hmm. if you get them, then you draw another one. And so you can keep getting more. And so it should be, in my mind, I was thinking of like a sort of a UN, like ideally everyone is supposed to be making their casting their votes and making their decisions for the good of the world, you mm-hmm. know, for the good of the United Nations or whatever it is. But at the same time, you also have your own secret agenda. You're like, I'm great. I'm all for the good of the world. Maybe there's not even combat. You know, now we've gotten rid of the risk too much, but
mm-hmm.
it could just be on, you know, teetering on the brink of war. Of course, none of us wants global war, but also I want to annex the Sudetenland. That's on my card. And so I'm going to vote that way. And no one else necessarily knows that that's what I need
mm-hmm.
or want. And so I don't know that necessarily even combat would be bad, but maybe global war would be the
mm-hmm.
the losing
condition
for yeah. everyone.
You could have a like a card that just sits by the board at the beginning of the game. That's like, don't have global war start.
Yeah.
And that's everybody's theoretically working toward it, but there's no benefit to getting it
right.
for any individual player.
Yeah.
It's just, we all win a little bit better maybe if we accomplish it.
Yeah.
But it's also not actually anybody's victory condition.
It's pretty close to that intergalactic politics game now that
we've
kicked around since we were in elementary school.
Yeah.
Like, if the idea is everything is teetering on the brink of global war, or in this case, galactic war, the idea is don't let that happen. But at the same time, you're still kind of, like, expansionist,
mm-hmm.
and you want the Sudetenland, or whatever it is.
You badly want that Sudetenland.
And so the game becomes, I guess it would have to be within a set number of turns, get all of the crap you can get without pushing over, you know, without mm-hmm. putting your toe over the line and starting global thermonuclear war.
Because that's bad. Nobody wants that. That sounds so freaking cool.
I think we have a few different potential interesting ideas here.
I'd play it twice.
I would play it once, probably halfway through, and after at the 16-hour mark, I'd be like, nope, okay, back to the drawing board.
Ah, neat.
Well, if you would play our particular version of intergalactic thermonuclear war, or if you have suggestions, or if you would like to tell us how much you love the Green Bay Packers, you could do that on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You could do it by email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You could do so in the comment section on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com or .com/dots, just put dots everywhere, in facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow. You can also rate and review us on...
I'm sorry, what did you say? Rate?
Rate. I did a glottal stop, so it was unclear, but
okay.
Generally in Michigan, that's a T.
Okay, yeah, I heard a different word.
Sure. Don't do the thing that Tom heard, but instead rate or review us on iTunes, Stitcher. I always want to say SoundCloud, but we're not on there.
TuneIn Radio. So wait, you're telling me people can't peep our SoundCloud?
And Google Play Music. Those are the places we are right now. We could make a SoundCloud. You have to pay money to have the entire run, but we can have, like, I think 7 episodes at a time or something.
Okay. Or you can just play a ham like the bongos.
What?
I don't know. It won't really get a message, just but you could do it. It's an option.
I don't know what he's talking about, but we'll see you next week.
Bye. The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by an empty white box that showed up at the studio. The mailman came to the door to hand it over, even though there isn't a delivery or return address on it, and when we opened it up, there was nothing inside. I've been feeling a bit nauseated ever since, though, and I keep seeing little shadowy movements out of the corner of my eye. And Johannes is sitting in the box.
I'm on a space adventure.
Sure thing, buddy.